From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Once upon a time, there was a young boy or an elderly couple or an abused stepdaughter who set off into the woods or to sell a cow or to go to the ball, and on the way encountered a nasty witch, a big bad wolf, a fairy godmother, but in the end, always lived happily ever after, right? Well, it depends who you ask. Fairy tales have long been the child's introduction to wonder, wickedness, and survival skills. The stories tell of the quest for romance, for riches, for power. They yield lessons and morals, but also moral ambiguities. The squeaky clean stories of Mother Goose and the Grimm brothers weren't always so squeaky clean. Many of the originals were gruesome, bloody, and bawdy. The author John Updike called them the television and pornography of their day. Over the years, they've been compiled, cleaned up, and packaged, but the root power of fairy tales endures. Tales of giants, glass slippers, and gingerbread houses still help shape the way we see good and evil and the world. Can you feel how fairy tales still grip your understanding of life and danger and possibility in an age of terror, war, and untidy endings? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio tonight is Maria Tatar, the John L. Loeb Professor of Germanic Languages and Literature at Harvard University and author and editor of a new book entitled The Annotated Classic Fairy Tales. Good evening and welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being with us. Take us right into the mindset of the fairy tale. You've got a little bit of Little Red Riding Hood here. Help us put us in fairy tale land.
Here's a version that your listeners may not be familiar with. I'll just read the end of it. Oh, Granny, what big nostrils you have. The better to sniff my tobacco with, my child. Oh, Granny, what a big mouth you have. The better to eat you with, my child. Oh, Granny, I need to go badly. Let me go outside. Do it in the bed, my child. No, Granny, I want to go outside. All right, but don't stay out long. The wolf tied a rope made of wool to her leg and let her go outside. When the little girl got outside, she attached the end of the rope to a plum tree in the yard. The wolf became impatient and said, Are you making a load out there? Are you making a load? When he realized that there was no answer, he jumped out of bed and discovered that the little girl had escaped. He followed her. But he reached her house only after she was already inside.
Happily ever after.
Definitely.
But
yes.
It was very close. She was in the bed with the wolf. Do it in the bed, he said. Things get pretty funky pretty fast in these fairy tales.
Right, right. And she, this little Red Riding Hood, she's a French little Red Riding Hood, doesn't need the help of a hunter at all. She just uses her own wits.
You write in the introduction I forget who said this, but that what fairy tales ultimately teach us is that we need a combination of cunning and high spirits to make it through this life.
Right. Cunning, courage, high spirits. This is what the philosopher Walter Benjamin said about fairy tales. He saw them as wonderfully utopian stories, stories that offered hope, that promised a happily ever after. But not with treacly sentimentalism at all.
And not without cunning. This wasn't just marching into the light. This was rely on your wits, young man, young woman, adult, whatever you may be, because life isn't all pretty.
Right, it's not. But that's the only way you can turn the tables on the rich and powerful.
Maria Tatar, right at the top of the book, you quote Arthur Schlesinger Jr., writing about classical tales, saying that they tell children what they unconsciously know, that human nature is not innately good, that conflict is real, that life is harsh before it is happy, and thereby reassure them about their own fears and their own sense of self. I'm not sure when Arthur Schlesinger wrote that, but you've spent so much time looking at these tales. Is the grip, the sway of fairy tales on the contemporary mind and our understanding of the world as strong as it ever was? Is it stronger because books are published and distributed everywhere? Is it weakening because televisions come in with Rugrats and a million other stories that may dilute the hold of classic fairy tales?
Well, sure. It's true that they don't have the powerful hold that they once did. And yet still, they're the stories that we all know. When my students take my course on fairy tales, almost all of them, even if they didn't grow up with the stories, they've gotten to know the stories through different media. That is, the media now circulates these stories in different forms. You find them in cartoons. You find them in advertisements. Look at recent films, Made in Manhattan, A New Cinderella, J-Lo as Cinderella,
right,
or 2 Weeks' Notice, or you can go back to Pretty Woman or Working Girl. There's so many different recyclings of the Cinderella
story. They keep
story.
reappearing in a new guise.
Exactly. So in a sense, you know, we may not always read the story in a book, but we still know the story.
And Schlesinger's point that fairy tales kind of pull the covers back for children and show them, he says, what they unconsciously know, that it can get pretty ugly out there. How important is that role?
So fairy tales give children, I think, a safe space to explore some of their own feelings, some of their own conflicts that they feel. But also they give them a chance to talk about and to think about scary things in the world, issues that adults sometimes are afraid to bring up with them. Fairy tales give them a way of talking about death, about scary creatures like wolves, predators out in the wolves.
Death and murder.
Exactly. Yeah, that dark forest, which is frightening for the child. But to me, the story gives the child a kind of safe way of talking about these things.
And when you look out on the world today with plenty of real-life scary things going on, with terrorists in our midst, or at least have been not so long ago, and the notion that bad things can happen very quickly, with enemies who are and friends labeled good and evil in very clear terms, I wonder if it doesn't go through your mind at some point the extent to which the models from fairy tales, the stories from fairy tales, the understandings developed in fairy tales still color and shape our sense of the world. Are we lifelong prisoners or beneficiaries, if you will, of the expectations and the molds that fairy tales offer us?
Well, fairy tales certainly give us a world of what you might call naive morality, because everything is cast in these polarized terms, good or evil. And there really doesn't seem to be much of a gray area in between. What we're finding in our culture is that there's been an effort to rewrite the stories to show that there are, in fact, some gray areas. For example, The Three Little Pigs. You can now read it in the Grimm's version, or you can take a look at John Sheetska's The Three Little Pigs told by Alexander Wolf. And suddenly you have the story from a completely different point of view.
And the difference is?
Well, the wolf has his own story to tell, and maybe those pigs were not really so innocent and vulnerable after all. Maybe the wolf just had a cold that day, and that's why he was huffing and puffing and sneezing. Or you find that Cinderella's stepmother, we now have versions of Cinderella that tell the story from the point of view of the stepmother, and she also has a different story to tell. So it's a nice way of playing with the stories.
So diversity comes in here, the sense of a kind of a willingness to deconstruct and reconstruct fairy tales. But I guess I'm thinking just of the very big, simple kind of signal dynamics in the news of our time. For example, we see our president stand up and describe parts of the world as good and parts as evil, and Saddam Hussein as evil. Do those kind of characterizations, not in any way to trivialize the dangers represented there, but I guess I'm trying to get at how strong you think the molds of fairy tales are when our king, as it were, in fairy tale terms, stands up and pronounces some other power evil. Are fairy tales right in there, along with, biblical imagery, childhood lessons of good and bad, shaping our understanding of what he's saying and what it suggests, what it implies?
Well, they may be fueling it, but I think that anyone who is thoughtful about fairy tales, whether they're reading them to a 3-year-old or to an 8-year-old, is going to talk about the way in which, in fact, the world isn't divided up into pure good and pure evil. And that, in fact, there are these gray areas in between. The young child, of course, needs to think about morality in those polarized terms. But as the child matures, things start to change. And it seems to me that these stories become interesting, and the way that they should be used is not to sort of look at the letter of the story and take it completely literally, but to start talking about the story, use the story as a point of departure for a dialogue about our own values. Many of the stories that we read to children today were from the 19th century, a culture that embraced values that are very different from our own. So there's no reason why we should stick to that particular story, to that, you know, black and white, good and evil version.
Take us into the stories. Your book, The Annotated Classic Fairy Tales, is just a gorgeous book. Beautiful illustrations, which I think for a child are very much a part of the experience. I can still remember vividly certain pages of certain fairy tale books from childhood, horribly emblazoned some of them, but others, you know, as kind of icons now of images of romance, whatever. Where do you point in the fairy tales you've collected here to show us gray areas? Do we have to read between the lines of fairy tales, or are the fairy tales themselves loaded with the kind of ambiguity that you describe?
Well, I think that the gray areas emerge as you're reading the story and talking about the story and thinking about the different possible endings for the story. Remember, these were tales that were once part of an oral storytelling culture, so that they were used to sort of navigate reality, to think about, to digest what had happened during the day, to see how it could be shaped into a story that might take you into fantasy.
You make a reference to William Bennett's Book of Virtues, a collection of stories chosen for their ability to transmit timeless and universal cultural values to children. Is that what fairy tales do, or is there some other purpose? Are fairy tales really vessels for transmitting an outline of the moral life?
They certainly do give us lessons, but what Bennett does is to tell us that every fairy tale gives us one single sentence, and he usually sums it up for the readers in a single sentence. The Three Little Pigs, for example, for him is a story that tells children, if you have the right tool, you can do the job right. If you look at the Three Little Pigs closely, it's really not about that. The third little pig manages to outwit the wolf, and again, the importance of cunning is emphasized in that story, because he not only keeps the wolf from destroying his house, but he manages to eat the wolf for supper, to trick him into coming down the chimney. It seems, and of course, don't forget that there are hundreds of versions of the Three Little Pigs. So to say that there's one moral lesson about the right tool, which gets the job right, seems to me a great mistake, because what we do is, over time, we keep changing the story. We keep rewriting it and producing new stories that make sense for us and that help us make sense of the world.
So when you went back through many versions of old fairy tales to choose the versions, or perhaps do some writing yourself for this collection, are you then suddenly the contemporary old woman by the fireplace deciding what the kids need to hear tonight?
Well, what I wanted to do was to capture...
Not that you're an old woman. You're glamorous, young, and supple.
Thank you. What I wanted to do is to capture the stories at the point when they made the transition from an oral storytelling culture, when they were still close to the hearth and the fireside, to the point where they went between the covers of a book. Now, it turns out that many of those versions that I have in the book are the ones that are still canonical today. But, of course, we do have Walt Disney, who has come along and given us very powerful versions of these stories. And so I think readers of this book will find that the Disney version will suddenly find that, you know, the Disney version is not really, sometimes it's usually close to the original, but it deviates in many ways from the first written versions that we have.
We're going to come back and talk about the history, the Disneyfication, the modern presentation of fairy tales and how they work in our lives today. We're talking about fairy tales, their grip on us, their mixed messages, their allure. Do you still hear the lessons of childhood fairy tales, of Little Red Riding Hood, of Jack and the Beanstalk?
When you confront the world today, do the lessons of fairy tales shape our response to threats and opportunities? Right now, we're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Join us. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about fairy tales, about their grip on us, about their mixed messages and their allure. My guest is Maria Tatar. She's the John L. Lowe Professor of Germanic Languages and Literature at Harvard University and author and editor of a beautiful new book, The Annotated Classic Fairy Tales. It's got a couple of dozen or more fairy tales, Maria, plus lots of information about the origins and implications of those fairy tales. Beautiful illustrations as well. Listeners, you can join us. Do fairy tales teach us that the world is just or that the world is wild and scary? Did Hansel and Gretel traumatize you as a child? Are you still afraid of bony-fingered strangers? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's get a quick question in. Dana's on the line. Welcome, Dana. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Hi.
Hi. I would just like to ask, when you mentioned Made in Manhattan as an updated Cinderella.
This is the Jennifer Lopez movie. Came out. Didn't get a really great response, but it's out.
Yes. Okay. Well, I'm kind of glad it didn't, because I didn't see it, but I saw the trailers, and it strikes me as racist and kind of like creating, you know, class disparities where she is climbing socially to marry a white, rich yuppie.
This is the Hispanic maid,
yes.
i.e. a cleaner of homes in Manhattan, who is
right.
Cinderella style, swept up into the realm of this rich white guy.
Mm-hmm. And all her friends, all her non-white friends who work with her, her Latino and black, are just happy to, you know, clean hotels and boogie and dance. You know, I mean, there's some, and I was just wondering if that racist or class element struggle was prevalent in any early versions of Cinderella. Like, well, maybe it could be. I'd like to elucidate on that, please.
It's a great question. Stick with us, Dana. Maria, how about it? Are these strange threads that have always been part of fairy tales, or is this something we're adding in 2003?
Well, we are adding it in, but it wasn't completely absent. There's one French version of Cinderella which is constantly emphasizing the whiteness of the heroine's hands. This is what makes her beautiful, her paleness, her whiteness, her fairness.
Was that in opposition to the bloody Moor?
The interesting thing is at the wedding, some dark Moors do show up who are seen as devilish characters. So even these early versions that were told around the fireside, even in France and in European countries, had racist elements. There's one story, The Jew and the Thorn Bush, in the collection of the Brothers Grimm. Mm-hmm. It's still there today, and it's a virulently anti-Semitic story.
So to Dana's point, are these tales like sponges that suck up the prejudices of their day? Do they become invested with the perspective
Certainly they, and this is what makes the older fairy tales so interesting, is that they do give us a window into the culture. I think your caller's point, though, that our new Cinderella, this Made in Manhattan film, takes up issues that really concern us today. And it doesn't surprise me. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if the filmmakers hadn't deliberately invested the film with some of those questions. And they should get us talking and thinking and debating and critiquing the way in which the two characters are positioned.
Dana, do you imagine that Made in Manhattan is a deliberate prod to thought or something less well considered?
A long shot. I mean, it's probably just a showcase for General Lopez, for Jennifer Lopez.
Okay.
And I also think it's more of a sending a message. The movie sends a message that it's better to be in the circles of white, rich yuppies than, you know, it is to be of the lower class. Like, it's definitely a political message that the movie is sending. I think Maiden and what's that other, another, You've Got Mail kind of sent the same message that the big guys are the good guys.
Well, there it is. It may be inevitable that these stories soak up the ethos of the moment. Dana, thank you for your call. Maria Tatar, it'd be great if you'd give us another little bit of a reading. We heard from a fairy tale we know well at the beginning of the hour, A Little Red Riding Hood. Here's a little bit from one I know less well, The Juniper Tree, but you describe it as a fairly harrowing tale. Can you set us up and give us just a bit of it?
It is. Well, let me start with the stepmother, who doesn't like her stepson. He comes home one day, and the little boy bent down. The devil prompted her, and bam, she slammed the lid down so hard that the boy's head flew off and fell into the chest with the apples. Then she was overcome with fear and thought, how am I going to get out of this? The stepmother then tries to blame her own daughter for the death, and she puts the head back on the boy's body, and when the daughter comes home, the daughter pulls the kerchief of the boy, trying to rouse him, and she comes running into the kitchen and says, Mother, I've knocked brother's head right off. And she was crying so hard she couldn't stop. Little Marlena, said her mother, what a dreadful thing you've done, but don't breathe a word to a soul, for there's nothing we can do. We'll cook him up in a stew. That stew is then placed before the boy's father, and it goes from there. But it does end happily. The father eats it with gusto.
So it gets pretty wild out there.
It does, but the boy does return. He's buried. He returns as a bird. He gets his revenge, and father, daughter, and son live happily ever after.
Somehow I doubt if that one gets into William Bennett's Book of Virtues.
Well, you'd be surprised what's in there. My favorite Bennett story is Rebecca, who slammed doors and perished miserably, which teaches children how to be polite.
You reference the uses of enchantment, Bruno Bettelheim's huge book on the fairy tale front, so influential for so many years, and you quote him there in his argument that fairy tales have a powerful therapeutic value, teaching children that, quote, a struggle against severe difficulties in life is unavoidable if one does not shy away, Bettelheim added, with great optimism, you say, but steadfastly meets unexpected and often unjust hardships. One masters all obstacles and at the end emerges victorious. Now, when you have your little editorial comment in there saying that was optimistic on his point, is it an accurate description of what fairy tales tend to tell us, that if you persevere with cunning and gusto, you will emerge victorious? Are you casting doubt on that, or are you simply saying that life may not be so simple?
Well, no, I'm not casting doubt on that. I suppose the problem is that Bettelheim compresses a lot into that one sentence, and he makes it sound a little easier than it is. It's not as if one reads the story and is suddenly whole and healthy. But, you know, that fairy tale gives us a small piece, something to think about, something to chew on, something that can help us and guide us.
Give us a very quick little tour here through some of the well-known fairy tales in your book, where you take us straight to the kind of the takeaway, or can you do that? Are you prepared to see, like, I don't know, Rapunzel? What jumps out at you from that very familiar tale as the takeaway that we may have missed in sanitized versions, or may never have really understood or articulated?
Well, one of the things that happens to Rapunzel, who's been put up in that tower and isolated to keep her safe and virtuous, is that she becomes pregnant. The prince has been coming to visit her on a daily basis. She's so innocent and naive that she doesn't even realize that one can become pregnant. So her clothes are getting tight. Mm-hmm. And she asks the enchantress, why are my clothes getting so tight? Of course, the enchantress then immediately knows what is going on. Mm-hmm. But you could see that as a story that in another time and place might have been a lesson to parents that it may not be such a good idea to lock your daughter up.
Because even if she's locked up, she won't know about the world.
She'll find a way to meet a prince, and she won't know anything about the consequences of meeting the prince.
No small number of these fairy tales have to do with, I don't know, pubescent girls or just coming into their sexual adolescent girls.
Yeah.
Coming to grips with, I suppose, in the time many fairy tales were written, was quite a mysterious continent of sexuality.
Right. And these have sometimes been called old wives' tales. That is, they were told around the fireside, often with groups of men in taverns, but often women around the fireside, sewing, spinning, taking care of household chores. This was a way of talking about courtship, about romance, about the hazards of marriage, about what one needs to make a good marriage.
And talking about all that in a way that was not akin to our modern sex advice columns.
No, but of course we have the sort of cleaned up, sanitized versions of the stories. So who knows what they were talking about. But my guess is they were certainly bawdier than the versions that we now have.
Beauty and the Beast, is that in the same vein?
Beauty and the Beast is a fascinating story because it tells us basically that what a woman needs is compassion. For a good marriage, you have to feel not passion, but compassion for your mate. If you think about it, that might not have been bad advice for a young woman who was facing an arranged marriage. A woman who found her older husband slightly repulsive and was terrified of him. And that story had a certain consolatory power in telling the young woman, well, you know, if you transform your feelings of revulsion into compassion, things may work out well for you in the end. Now, for our own culture, it may not work as well. And there, I think, you know, we really have to ask questions of that story and say, is this right for us?
Well, in that way, these are like time capsules. I mean, I'm not sure if feminists would advise compassion as the first approach of a contemporary woman to a contemporary man. It may not be a bad idea, but it seems like antique advice right now.
Well, certainly not compassion alone. Mm-hmm. That certainly isn't what we think of as the most powerful ingredient in a marriage. And, of course, don't forget, she's called Beauty.
Right. So. And he's the Beast. Jack and the Beanstalk moves us into a different realm, a kind of a realm of great power and less power, of wealth and less wealth, and in a way of theft, maybe justified theft, revenge?
He is a trickster. He starts out with what? Three beans. He's a ne'er-do-well. One of the things that fairy tales tell us is that the youngest, the simplest, the poorest can somehow inherit a kingdom. And that if you do go up that beanstalk and if you're not afraid of the giant, you can inherit his wealth.
And up Jack went, and he did inherit. There are a lot of callers who want to join us.
Yes.
Maria Tatar, please stand by. Rick's on the line. Welcome, Rick. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm glad to join the show.
Good to have you.
Well, this was a perfect segue because I had the pleasure of studying with Bruno Bettelheim when I was in college, as well as taking a look at many fairy tales from more of a psychoanalytic perspective, so that, for instance, some of these stories, the Three Little Pigs, can also be viewed as three stages of development. And as one matures, one finds more stable ways of dealing with things and becomes more responsible, or Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, the Seven Dwarves being, again, it being a girl's fantasy of father figure with seven different aspects to his personality and things of that nature. But an important point, I think a lot of what I'm hearing is an adult perspective reading the story and not understanding how a child sees this. And I think Bettelheim's point is important, that this is a way in fantasy for a child to work through many issues of power in an otherwise powerless situation. What we're calling cunning is really just another access to power, manipulation, as opposed to overt power, which adults have by being able to pick up a small child, or even worse, in other cultures.
You've got a great point there, Rick. I want to bring it straight up with Maria. What about the difference in the way a child's mind takes these stories on board and the way the adult who's reading the story or hearing the story hears them? Can we possibly imagine or remember the way they sounded as a six-year-old?
Right. It's an important difference. I think that my response to that would be we as adults do emphasize the therapeutic quality of fairy tales, and we think about them as bibliotherapy and all of that. How do kids perceive it? One of the things that I discovered as a mother reading these stories to my children is that children are sometimes captivated by details that seem totally unimportant to adults. When I was reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe to my daughter, what she was really fascinated by was Turkish Delight. And to this day,
the candy.
That, exactly, yes, this wonderful candy that the boy can't get enough of. So, and that to this day, The Lion and the Witch in the Wardrobe is about that. So I don't think we should underestimate the fact that a child will sometimes focus on a detail and take that from the story. Something beautiful, a beautiful image, mm-hmm. Like those images that you were fascinated with, or a sentence, or just an artifact in the story, which becomes very important. And oddly enough there, I mean, maybe that connects with bibliotherapy in that that word or image or object somehow becomes a source of comfort, of interest, deep interest. It often is a stimulus to the imagination, and it maybe opens the world up.
Maybe comfort that's much needed in the context of some of these rough stories. How do children take on the rough stuff in these stories? The juniper tree bit that you read, I hear that the boy's head is knocked off. It's served for dinner to his father. The father eats a stew with the son in it. What does a 4, 5, 6, 7, you name it, year old do with that? Do they tend to actively dive in and viscerally imagine that? Do they let it glide over because it's read to them in a cozy lap at bedtime? How does that work?
Well, that one I know the answer to, because I once read this to a group of 6-year-olds who laughed hilariously.
They laughed, of course. Here we are worried, and they're giggling.
Wonderful. Their favorite part was when the millstone falls on the stepmother's head at the very end of the story.
Yeah.
And somehow, you know, I mean, clearly this isn't always knee-slapping, ha-ha, funny, but there is, I mean, what your caller said before about this kind of therapeutic release. This is, you know, often we don't allow kids to talk about these sorts of matters. We want to keep them away from violence. We don't want them to learn about death until they're older. And suddenly, it's all there in a story, the things that have been prohibited, the things that they haven't been allowed to talk about.
Rick, do you see that still working for children in your world?
Oh, very much so. And I think, having had 4 children, none of whom are young enough to share fairy tales with now, but Bettelheim's point was indeed the changing, the retelling of the stories and making them, you know, less fantastic is actually doing a disservice, because if we can't work things through in fantasy, there's only the reality to work them through in, and that's far more destructive to have those things than to be able to satisfy a need through these fantastic stories.
So don't take away all the gnarly curlicues and difficult patches. They're actually very helpful. Rick, thanks for your call. Maria, what about that? How much has been ironed out of fairy tales over the years? Are we reading really sanitized versions? Not in your book, of course, but in the general run of print today?
Well, we're certainly reading branded versions of the tales. I mean, Disney has sort of made the fairy tales part of an industry. We also have, I mean, we have this wonderful volume, Politically Correct Bedtime Stories, which rewrites the stories to make them totally politically correct. And those are actually quite hilarious. I think, you know, one of the great things is that we rewrite the fairy tale in so many different ways. I mean, some appeal to me and some don't appeal to me, but we keep recycling them, and that's part of their magic.
And the kind of living legacy. They were talking tonight about fairy tales and their continuing grip on us. Have we Disneyfied all fairy tales today, diluted the menace? Do we lose something in that? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about fairy tales and their grip on us, their mixed messages, their allure. My guest is Maria Tatar. She's author of a wonderful new book, The Annotated Classic Fairy Tales. It's got a pile of wonderful fairy tales along with her really probing examination of where they came from, what they mean, and the illustrations that go along with them, how they've been interpreted through the years. Join us tonight. In a tough world, do we need tough fairy tales? And what qualities, what truths do fairy tales uphold? Do fairy tales still shape our notions of good and evil? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tim's calling from Cumberland, Rhode Island. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
It's a great conversation. I have 2 children, 4 and 5, and we read lots and lots of stories. And I often find that they're either, you know, so heavy-handed in their moral message that it's almost boring, or they're so sanitized, like the Disney versions, that there's nothing to them. And sort of to me, the stories don't even necessarily need to have a strong moral message. You know, I find that the kids like them just for creativity and just for, you know, magic, and they don't necessarily have to always have some heavy sort of pedantic message to them. And
that's a wonderful point.
You know, I'm just I like read the stories just to let them escape from this sort of boring strip mall world that they live in and be in a place where horses can fly and beanstalks can grow in the air without necessarily having to worry about all the time what's the message.
Tim, that's wonderful. Thanks for sharing. I see Maria nodding her head vigorously that they need not have morals of any kind, but a kind of just that fate and fortune and wonderment.
Right. They take children into a world of magic. And I think, you know, it's really only in the 18th century that we started adding all of these morals. Our early versions of Little Red Riding Hood didn't have the mother saying, now don't stray into the woods and don't go peeking in the corners when you get to grandmother's house.
But does that mean that they were any less loaded with messages? I mean, it's a pretty powerful warning all on its own without any elaboration in Little Red Riding Hood, isn't it?
Well, it is, but I mean, think about the story. Is it really about straying the path off the path? I mean, wasn't the wolf just there in the woods? The wolf certainly would have found her no matter what. So it doesn't seem to me that Little Red Riding Hood is really a transgressor. Often now we sort of rewrite the stories. We add these morals that make the children in the story look like transgressors, look like they've done something wrong, so that the story can teach the child outside the book a lesson.
So that everything is read as, look both ways before you cross the street or else you're the transgressor. So if it's not Little Red Riding Hood straying off the path that was at the heart of an earlier telling, how would you interpret it?
Well, it was about the dangers in the woods, in those dark areas. What could happen to you? What is the most terrible thing that you can imagine happening to you? And just moving into that world is so much more interesting and exciting than, you know, what Tim calls these sort of heavy-handed morals and messages that leave a child completely cold. By the way, Rousseau told us many years ago that if you tell a child a story with a moral or a message, the child is sure to turn it around. And
do the opposite.
And do exactly the opposite.
Thank God for that.
Right.
And I guess to the other point here, do you find in your travels through the world of fairy tales that parents are reading these to their children in the same with the same regularity and enthusiasm than they did a generation ago?
It's hard to assess that exactly, but what I am finding is that there's tremendous enthusiasm for these stories, in part because these are the stories that, since we grew up with them, it's wonderful to be able to transmit these stories to the next generation, to talk about them, to see what their effect is on the child, and it gives us all a kind of common narrative to think about things.
Tim, thanks for your call. Roger's calling. Welcome, Roger. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening, Tom and Maria. How are you?
Hi, fine, thanks.
Hi.
I just wanted to put in my two bids for my two favorites, then I'll get to my point.
Okay.
Billy Goat Gruff and the Russian tale about the house on chicken legs. Those are my two favorites.
Okay, now Billy Goat Gruff, I know, but A House on Chicken Legs, you've got me there.
What,
Maria, do you know that one?
Vasilisa the Fair, which is in Annotated Classic Fairy Tales, one of my favorites as well.
And the story or the moral of the story?
Vasilisa the Fair. Oh, you see, that's one. It's so complicated that one couldn't possibly break
no
it
summary.
Down. But there's a wonderful witch in there who does Baba Yaga.
There you go,
Baba Yaga.
With her hut standing on chicken legs, and unforgettable.
And Roger, you had a point to make beyond your favorites.
Yes. We're going back almost 60 years now. I always remember this line. I'm going away for a year and a day. Strange countries for to see. That's in the song. But in the stories, the fellow would go away for a year and a day. And it turns out in the past year or so, I read that if you could get into a town and stay for a year and a day, no matter your condition, you were given the liberties of the town. You were free, and you could go back and get your girl and possibly live happily ever after.
So the line stayed with you for 60 years,
yep.
And only now you've learned what it may mean.
Yep, within the past year or so.
I guess fairy tales must do that again and again. Roger, thank you for your call and for those wonderful memories. Maria, I suppose they leave us with images. You said it yourself before that children pick up on jewels, on odd bits of the story that remain kind of emanating, even if the meaning is not at all clear.
Right. One of the moments I remember from a version of Cinderella that I read was when the stepsisters have their heels cut off and their toes cut off. The stepmother does
that. To get them into the slippers.
Get them in.
Oh,
right.
Lord, that wasn't in my book.
They ended up with bloody shoes.
Blood in the silver slipper or the glass slipper.
Yeah.
Frank's on the line. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I had some stories read to me as a kid and was able to look at the pictures as well that stayed with me. I've stayed with them my whole life. I can still see them. And I'm thinking of my nieces and nephews, which number in the 20s at this point.
Yeah.
And I would like that they not have to look at things like that I saw.
Because the illustrations, the images were so frightening, Frank.
Yes, precisely.
Yeah.
And given our culture right now of fear that we have, that we're confronted with, that I would like the children to have a little more time where they don't have to feel like they're going to have to live by their wits as they get a little bit older.
Frank, this is such a great point. It really takes us right to the crux. Maria, these days, if you just leave the news on long enough around a six-year-old, they can become pretty freaked out in that environment. Are fairy tales a kind of piling on, or are they a way of making threats seem manageable? You know, do they grind children down to dust, or do they empower them through example or story?
Well, I think it's a way of helping children manage anxieties. I talked about stories as that kind of safe space to work through these anxieties. But I think your caller does have a point, though, too, because there are some children. And I think here we shouldn't so much rely on our own feelings, but observe the child. There are some children who really don't like this. I've taken kids to Disney movies, and sometimes an 8-year-old will be terrified by the stepmother in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. So one has to keep an eye on the child, observe the child. I think some children need to work through the stuff through stories. Others are better off with Curious George, something that is a little lighter and amusing. But even Curious George has its scary moments. So.
Sooner or later, they're going to run into the fairy tales.
Right.
You really can't avoid them forever. So give us a parting image here, a favorite image of yours from a fairy tale, one that sticks with you perhaps from your childhood, Maria Tatar.
I suppose the story that fascinated me as a child was Bluebeard, the story of Bluebeard. And my favorite moment was Bluebeard's wife standing at the door, seized with curiosity, wanting to look, wanting to find out what was behind the door, and yet afraid to open the door. And somehow it does seem to me that that space of the forbidden is what makes fairy tales so compelling.
And behind that door, the other wives of Bluebeard.
I'm afraid so, yes. The corpse
Close
is
the
hanging
door
on the
quick.
Wall.
Maria Tatar, it's been wonderful having you this evening. Thanks so much for coming
Thanks
in.
Thanks for inviting me.
And congratulations on a beautiful book. Maria Tatar is author and editor of the new book, The Annotated Classic Fairy Tales. Check it out. She's also John L. Loeb Professor of Germanic Languages and Literatures at Harvard University. To continue this conversation, join us online at onpointradio.org and click on forums. Maria, thanks so much.
Thanks, too.
Listeners, in a moment, Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair defends the United Kingdom's special relationship with the U.S., but also gives some advice. This is On Point. Britain today called up 1,500 reservists and ordered a naval amphibious force to the Persian Gulf as part of the military buildup heading heralding a possible U.S.-led strike against Iraq. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Tony Blair defended himself against critics who have called him President Bush's lapdog. In a speech before Britain's 150 ambassadors today, Blair said the UK should remain America's closest ally, but added that the United States needs to pay more attention to the needs of the world community. Here are excerpts from Tony Blair's speech.
We should remain the closest ally of the United States, and as allies, influence them to continue broadening their agenda. We are the ally of the US not because they are powerful, but because we share their values. I'm not surprised by anti-Americanism, but it is a foolish indulgence. For all their faults, and all nations have them, the United States are a force for good. They have liberal and democratic traditions of which any nation can be proud. And you know, I sometimes think it's a good rule of thumb to ask of a country, are people trying to get into it or out of it? Not a bad guide as to what sort of country it is. Quite apart from that, it is massively in our self-interest to remain close allies. Bluntly, there are not many countries who wouldn't wish for the same relationship with the United States that Britain has, and that includes most of the ones most critical of that relationship in public. But we should use this alliance to good effect. The problem people have with the United States, not rabid anti-Americans, I mean the average middle ground, is not that, for example, they oppose them on terrorism or weapons of mass destruction. People listen to the US on these issues and may well agree with them, but they do want the United States to listen back. So for the international community, the Middle East peace process is also important. Global poverty is important. Global warming is important. The United Nations is important. The U.S. choice to go through the UN over Iraq was a vital step in itself and as a symbol of their desire to work with others. A broader agenda is not inimical to the U.S., on the contrary. For example, the U.S. decision to back a new relationship between NATO and Russia has made both missile defense and NATO enlargement easier and less divisive. The price of British influence is not, as some would have it, that we have continually and obediently to do what the US asks. I would never commit British troops to a war that I thought was wrong or unnecessary. Where we disagree, as over Kyoto, we disagree. But the price of our influence is that we do not leave the United States alone to face the tricky issues. And by tricky, I mean the ones which people wish weren't there, don't want to deal with. And if I can put it a little pejoratively, know the United States should confront, but want the luxury of criticizing them for it. So if the US act alone, they are unilateralist, but if they want allies, people shuffle to the back.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair speaking earlier today to a gathering of the UK's ambassadors. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakravarti, Eileen Imada, Tamar Morad, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. With help from Todd Brubaker, Jared Mnuchin. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Sets and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.